to you by Barfoot and Thompson.
On the show today, how to reset your money mindset and find financial freedom. Every woman's guide to money, money, money. Welcome to Property Matters. Welcome along to another Monday. It's getting a little bit cooler here in Auckland, but thank you for tuning in, whether you're listening live to Planet FM or you've downloaded one of our podcasts, which is available from all your favourite podcast site. Thanks for tuning in. Now, I'm really delighted today to be in two cities at once, because we're that sort of people. We have in studio, I am delighted to welcome Angela Meyer. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And joining us from Wellington, we have Rachel Davies. Welcome, Rachel.
Kia ora, Stephen. It's great to be here.
Great to have you both here. And look, technically, we're here to talk about your book, Money, 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 but, you know, we're going to get to know you both as well and your own journeys, both as authors and financial experts, I'm going to call you tonight. All right, no pressure. But it's great to have you both here. And look, for listeners who haven't come across your book yet, how do you both describe money, money, money in just a sentence or two? Rachel, do you want to kick that off?
Money, money, money is everything I always wanted to know about money, from the psychology to the system to the practical tools. And it would have changed my life at any time I would have had it. It's everything I wanted to know.
Ooh, it's one of those ones where I, you know, often say to people, if you could go back and talk to your 16-year-old self, what would you say? So you would say, read this book. You'd just hand them the book and walk away. Yeah, okay, all right. Angela, what about you?
I would say actually something very similar. I often describe it to people when I'm meeting them. I'm like, honestly, if you read nothing else, read this book and you should be fine.
So why did you feel a specifically sort of every woman's guide to money mindset and financial freedom was needed right now in Aotearoa?
Mainly because we actually have a gendered financial crisis going on in this country. And that's because there is a 25% gap in gendered retirement savings. So that means that a lot of women are retiring into poverty. And we've also got a gender pay gap. And we really kind of thought, well, how can it be that women are retiring into poverty? There's got to be something else going on here. Mm. And that's why we wanted to write a book that really looked at, as Rach said, the systemic stuff, the psychological stuff, and then offer some really practical, useful tools about money management.
So that gives a nice sort of segue to the little endorsement you have on your front cover then when you're talking about retirement, because Jane writes and the Retirement Commissioner says this is the missing piece of the financial puzzle. So that's really cool. So, Rachel, did you get Jane to read your book?
Yeah, we've worked with Jane quite a lot and really loved Jane, and she was like, you know, she looked at the gap between men and women in their KiwiSaver starts at 18. It's like, she was like, what's going on? Like, what's stopping women? And when we sort of addressed the psychology piece as well, particularly, she's like, this is the missing piece. Everything in this book is the missing piece. It's not, women don't need more spreadsheets or more budget calculators. There's plenty of those. It's something else going on, maybe around how women are socialised or beliefs or different kinds of structures. So that's what we really try to dig into in the book.
Yeah, and she was wonderful. She launched the book for us down in Wellington and gave, we'd sent her a copy of the book, and she gave this wonderful speech where she was like, you know, it's a feminist attack on the monetary system and it's this wonderful psychological thing and you also get practical tips. We were just both sort of standing there going, wow, this is great. And, you know, Jane is a fierce, you know, she's an incredible woman and she's not afraid to call out any kind of injustice or any kind of gap that she sees.
Look, can you think of it as sort of a childhood memory or perhaps early adulthood that shapes how you personally think about money today that may have, I guess, triggered some of this?
Yeah, I mean, we go into it in the book. We both share a little bit about our money stories. Mm. And what, well, for me personally, I grew up in a household where money was a kind of a boom and bust situation. So my father was incredibly entrepreneurial, but not particularly good at money management.
Right.
So my family went bankrupt twice, and that was really humiliating. And it also really set, I suppose, the scene for me and really influenced my own money story and my own set of money beliefs. And so as I got older, I realised that they were really still influencing me, and I really wanted to change that. And so that's kind of one of the things that has been really instrumental, was unpacking where I had these beliefs from, understanding that the story can change, and that just because my father was both entrepreneurial but not particularly good at managing money didn't mean that I had to be like that as well.
Nice. Okay. And Rachel?
This one isn't in the book, but I was talking to a friend the other day, and we'd both sort of grown up in the arts in Wellington, and you know, in the 90s in Wellington, there was a lot of filmmaking happening, and everybody I knew was, you know, we're all just living the creative life. And she said, most of my retirement is at the Paradiso Bar in Courtney Place, where we would all go all the time. And I was like, oh, that's so true. Like, you know, I think my peers really shaped my spending. Like, once I left school and I was working in the arts, it was about having a lot of fun. It was about being at cool places and wearing cool clothes. And I just did that. I invested in that. And I wish, you know, if I could go back in time again, I wish I could at least have put the price of one margarita into an index fund, you know, every week or something. Because, yeah, just trying to keep up. And what was modelled for me by my friends and that lifestyle was have fun now. Don't worry about it. It will sort itself out, you know, later. So, yeah, I don't do that anymore. That's been changed.
No more margaritas.
I was going to say, we've moved from margaritas to flat whites as Wellington. It's got to be a good coffee. Come on.
But also just to say that, you know, back in the, you know, like I was doing similar things as well. And back then, though, it was actually really hard to get access to information and education around index funds, around investing, you know, and it used to be that you'd need to have at least 10 grand before you could actually start investing. So, I think it's important that we also understand that these things are, you know.
We didn't have all the apps and the technology.
We didn't have that information. And so, like Rach, certainly there's been a lot of drinks that, honestly, sometimes I do wonder, could have bought me a house, maybe.
So what was your sort of own money reset moment? The point that you realised, actually, my current approach to money isn't working and something has to change?
Well, for me, that's in the, you know, the intro of the book is like I'd come back from America. I'd been travelling for 8 years, and my mum was dying of cancer, and I was back, and I didn't even have a KiwiSaver. So we sort of washed back into New Zealand with a suntan and, you know, not much else. And I started working with Ange at Double Denim, and she said, do you know that women are like a third more likely to retire into poverty or have 25% less in their KiwiSavers? And it struck me like an arrow through the heart. I was like, I am on track for that. Like, I haven't thought about this at all. And so that was really the beginning of this work for me. Like, it was when we started to explore therapy tools rather than just sort of budgeting tools. Mm. And that was what really sort of reset it for me. And Ange and I did an exercise where we talked to money, which is a sort of a classical therapy thing where you like talk to a cushion as if it's your mum or something. And I was like, well, let's talk to something as if it's money. And when I did that, I realised that I'd never treat a person the way that I treated money. I just treat it without respect. I'd spend tons and not look at my bank account because I didn't want to. I'd feel shame and I didn't want to stop spending. And then I would, you know, sort of ghosting it and binging it and purging it. And if that was a friend, they just wouldn't ever call me back. It was terrible behaviour. And so in that sort of therapy exercise, I just had a lot of light bulbs. And I was like, this has got to change, and it's got to change right now. I wouldn't do that to anybody, and I'm not going to do it to money.
Nice. Angela, you talk about money mindset in the book, but before you wrote it, what was that sort of unhelpful belief? Was it similar to what Rachel's saying that kind of made you say, I need to confront this and change it?
Yeah, it was really similar. It was also, I had been running an agency for a long time, and in all other sort of aspects of my life, I was pretty responsible and I could sort things out. But for some reason, there was this real block with money. And that my father died, actually, owing a lot of money. And so for me, there was this real kind of link between debt and death. And there was a lot going on there. And we were doing a big piece of work with the agency in Australia around superannuation. And somehow we'd sort of got this job and then I had to just like dive, feet first into this whole world of money and turn it into language that was easily accessible. And so it was a real kind of come to Jesus moment, actually. And that's also when we realised that, women were retiring into poverty. It was, I was like, wow, I am very much on track to be one of those people. And I really wanted to try and do something about that. And through Double Denim, we'd run a series of different events and, had just been really curious and trying to understand, well, what will be the thing that shifts it for me? Mm. And as Rach mentioned, when we started approaching money like a relationship and understanding that, this is one of the trickiest, longest relationships you're probably going to have in your life, and also how money affects relationships, was a really, really great way in for me. And we noticed that that was actually something that a lot of women, especially women, were really excited to explore as well, which is why we set up High Money, which is our business.
So how did the two of you meet? How many margaritas? Yeah. Come on.
Yeah. We sort of moved in similar circles, but had never really properly met until Rach had come back from...
From Hawaii and had sort of rocked into Double Denim to see what was happening. And I guess that's when we really started to hang out a lot. But we moved in the same circles for a couple of decades, I'd say.
Yeah. Sort of arts adjacent, and when I was overseas, Rach was there. When Rach was overseas,
nice.
And then we finally got into the same city,
and then wrote a book. Walk us through the book. What are the key topics you're covering in here?
Well, it's divided into kind of four main sections. There's the section at the, there's an introduction, and then there's a section called It's the System Sister. Mm-hmm. And that's really like breaking down all of the different ways in which women find it more difficult, actually, to experience financial well-being. So things like the pink tax, for example, which there was a really interesting study done in New York, and they were able to quantify that over a woman's lifetime, and it worked out to be at about $188,000 on women having to pay money for things that are either marketed to women, so like razors and pens that are pink, and then things like the cost of haircuts and menstrual products and all of those things. So, sort of rough estimation, that's about 250,000 New Zealand. And then there's a section about the psychology. So that's really, there's some great exercises in there to help people explore their money psychology. Then there's a section called the practical stuff, which is, this is how you set up an emergency fund, etc. And then we've really wanted to include a section about money in couples and what happens when love and money meet and the law gets involved. Because... Right. We'd noticed over the time that we've been working in this space that a lot of women come to this mahi at a time when maybe they have going through a divorce, or they might have just inherited a lot of money. There's some focusing event that suddenly they want to really understand their relationship with money.
Do you encourage women to find their voice in those situations?
100%. Yeah.
So important.
Yeah.
That was a good snapshot of the book. Rachel, do you think she missed anything?
Oh, yeah, she missed women's stories. Another really cool thing is all through the psychology section, we interview women and they tell us their money stories. And a lot of people really love just reading different women's experiences because when we do the high money Zooms and, you know, women go into breakout rooms and tell each other their money stories, they usually come out with kind of shiny eyes and they're like, oh, my God, it's not just me or... Oh, so there's something really lovely, like Ange and I wanted to write a book that was filled with women's, all sorts of different women's voices, because everyone's so different with money and has such different backgrounds, and we sort of just wanted to, so that was another part. There's just tons of stories and voices and quotes from all sorts of different people,
Yeah, and we did also speak to, you know, some really amazing experts as well, because... we're not financial advisors and we wanted to speak to, you know, people who are experts in that field as well. And we've spoken to a lawyer and, so often finance books, personal finance books will be the story of one person and how they overcame their challenges and became wealthy. And that's not what this book is. It's really... lots of different voices, and we hope that there's an opportunity for people to find a moment of connection with one of those people, or maybe more.
That's cool. Rachel, mindsets are, you know, a really big concept to talk about. What are some simple sort of observable signs that someone's mindset around money is starting to shift in a healthier direction?
I think my experience of that is that when people get clear about, like, their ideas about money, or they might have a belief about money and they'll look at it and be like, oh, that's a bit wonky, actually. Like, do you really have to work really, really hard for money? Or is a prince actually coming on a white horse to save me? Or, like, when you surface one of those beliefs and go, well, actually, maybe I'll save myself, or maybe there's lots of different ways to make money, things get simpler and more relaxed, you know, like, so I think for me, when someone's done lots of money mindset work, they just feel a bit more like calm, things are simpler, because when people's beliefs line up with who they really are and what they really value, they're sort of in line, rather than they're believing some strange thing their mum told them 50 years ago that isn't really true, and it's sort of clanging around in the background there, making them do weird spending things, and that's sort of got a slightly wobbly feeling. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and you know, there was research done that showed that often people's money mindsets, or the way they think about money, was set by about the age of 7. So, as Rach said, you know, so many of us have kind of been ruled by a 7-year-old or 7-year-old idea of money, rather than actually having the time and space to explore your relationship with money and realise that some of those things may not be true. They, you know... You can change the story.
You can update and make it match you right now, or, you know, just have a look and see what you want to keep and what you want to change with your beliefs and your ideas. Yeah.
So, Angela, without giving the whole book away, what are a couple of practical tools you walk readers through so they can move from theory into action?
Well, one of them that we've developed is called The Why Behind the Buy. And so this is a kind of a nice hybrid one, I would say. So this kind of came out of the fact that once you become a little bit more conscious of your spending, you have an opportunity to change that, for example. So I noticed that when I was at work, I would really like to get out of the office. And so I would say, I'm just going to go and get a coffee. And the thing is, I didn't actually really want a coffee. I just wanted to get out of the office. I wanted a change of scene. I wanted to, you know, change up my situation. And the why behind the buy is actually invites you to sort of take stock of how you're feeling before you spend, and then look at what you're spending and what you're spending that on, and then how you felt afterwards. So it's a very simple exercise, but actually you get a lot of information out of it. And then you get a chance to kind of look back over that, say, over a week and go, wow, I noticed that I'm actually not really wanting coffee at all. For example, I just want to get outside. And I can go outside.
Without spending.
Yeah, and I can go for a walk without spending. We also have information in there about, you know, how to start investing, setting up an emergency fund, paying yourself first, you know, some really sort of foundational things that seem like, you know, oh yeah, we've all heard those before, but they really do make a difference.
Yeah, and things like that emergency fund, just to stop you hitting into that credit scenario, because we all have the dentist moment or anything that, you know, that crops up and you wish you had that money there that you didn't need to whip out the credit card, that then just adds further to the debt.
And we also talk about, you know, consolidating, you know, that high interest debt, and just we try and do it in a way that is as judgment-free and as shame-free as possible, you know.
So look, a lot of women carrying debt, sometimes with shame attached, as you mentioned. How do you suggest people approach debt in a way that's constructive rather than paralysing themselves?
For me, you know, there's different kinds of debt. Like, I feel different about my credit card debt to my mortgage or when I had a student loan. So I think, you know, maybe they've got a different quality, but the debt that I feel the most ashamed about is usually my credit card debt or the stuff where I'm spending money that I haven't got yet and sort of, what's that saying, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And I think for me, the best way is to not feel ashamed about it and just to take a deep breath and have a look and be like, well, do I really want to be doing this, or what could I do differently? Maybe I just need to do this right now to get through this tough time, or maybe in 6 months I can review it, or maybe there's a little bit of wiggle room here where I could start to lower that credit card debt and have a bit more space, or I could give up some things. Or so I'd sort of, just judgment-free and calm and just having a nice clear look for me is how I like to sort of approach that.
We live now in this world of buy now, pay later. Every single thing now that you, even if you're booking a doctor's appointment, it's giving you the option to after pay it. How do we sort of protect people from that mindset of I need it now? Because there was a time when we just couldn't do that.
I think that is where, you know, a lot of this work comes into play, because it's like once you get clear about what you value and also you like the why behind the buy, all of those things, like you, when you are clear about what you want money for and what that means in a bigger way than just, you know, I want to go to the doctor or whatever it might be, and you go, actually, do I want to buy this now? And what is the effect of that on my long-term goals or on my short-term goals or on my medium goals? And so it's that real clarity of understanding what money means to you right now. What do you want it to mean, and where do you want to go with it? And I do think we need some system change there and some legislation, because it is incredibly attractive and the way that it's set up is, you know, I think it's kind of predatory for a lot of people.
Definitely.
As well.
And we've talked to credit providers on this show, you know, who talk about the impact that that makes on your credit, not in a good way, you know. Look, your book focuses for women, but already I'm hearing so many things that men can grab from this as well. Is this, you know, this
the husbands and the blokes are going to be stealing their book off.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, as I said at the, you know, top of the interview, like, we wrote it because we saw a real need and a real problem that was women retiring into poverty. But we also did a really interesting piece of research as part of this book called Rich in Context, where we looked at the socio-cultural determinants of financial well-being, which sounds quite dry, but it's actually fascinating. And what we discovered was that 30% of all of the people that we surveyed, and that was across Australia and New Zealand and all genders, had no financial plan whatsoever other than winning lotto. And so this is the way that we think and feel about money is not unique to women, but it is, you know, we have different things that influence us. So I think there's definitely something in it for everybody.
That's
for sure.
A nice segue to my next question, which was New Zealand has its own particular housing and cost of living story. How do you think the sort of the Kiwi context is shaping a woman's sense on, you know, what's possible financially or being, I guess, financially free?
I mean, it is really hard at the moment. I think we'd be lying to say that people aren't stressed about money. And I think we do have a lot of policy settings in this country that don't take into account the specific aspects of women's lives and the responsibilities. So, for example, you know, it's only been in the last year that the KiwiSaver settings have changed. Mm. And prior to that, you know, KiwiSaver is actually tied to employment. And if you have caregiving responsibilities, you're not able to, you know, you're not getting money into your KiwiSaver, you're not getting that employer contribution. And so our whole system is really set up not to take into account all of this work that is done that actually is part of the market but is not valued by the market. So I think, you know, understanding that there's a lot that's also going on, it's not just, you know, like feel better about money and, you know, sort of manifest your way out of it. That's absolutely not what this book and what we're saying. We're saying it's really tricky. We understand that. And system change is really long, hard work, which, you know, we're up for. But it's also being able to give women some agency and some understanding themselves, because you can't budget your way out of poverty in this situation. Yeah.
Rachel, some listeners might feel they're too late to start investing or getting serious perhaps about property. What would you say to someone who's listening right now and feels like they've missed the boat?
I just think it's never too late. Like, I mean, I started my KiwiSaver at 49, which is, you know, many people would say it was too late. But, and if I'd started at 18, you know, maybe I would be retired right now. But my 80-year-old self is going to be really happy I started. So I just think, I mean, there's no, for me, it's like there's no point beating myself up. Let me just get on with it now. And that's great. That's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. What no retrospective beating up. Yeah. And it's amazing how fast you can grow your KiwiSaver or your savings or your investing. Like Rach, I didn't really get into this, you know, until about 10 years ago. And I was, you know, since then I've got a property, you know, and I've got a share portfolio and things that I literally never thought I'd be able to have. And so, you know, they often talk about consistency and time in the market. Like, all of those things are true for a reason, because they do work.
And I guess that's where that technology does help now, because you can have apps that enable you to just put a little away, a little here and there, and grow it. Yeah, what were your own professional backgrounds before becoming sort of authors into this space? What was your background that led to this experience? Because you've both mentioned arts and film and things, and I'm an artistic person. I mean, my background is in theatre, and quite often artists aren't the greatest with money, 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 so they need to be reading this book. So, you know, I'm a little surprised that your background is in the creatives, but then led into this space.
Yeah.
Well, I was a filmmaker. I was a director for 20 years, and then I went into therapy. I think filmmaking and working with actors sort of led, and storytelling led quite easily into therapy. And then, and I think, like you say, money maybe came up for me as an artist because I had been so disregarding of it for such a long time, and it sort of really got crunchy, and I was like, okay, what am I going to do? And then I, of course, you know, just brought the tools that I've been working with, like, you know, 80% of everything is how you think and feel about it rather than the facts. And so just applying that sort of lens, and that, you know, it was really transformational for me to do that. So that was my background. Yeah, art first and therapy later.
Yeah, and mine is, I've got, a degree in theatre as well, Showtime. And storytelling has always been really central to that. And I think also, you know, when you work in theatre or in the arts and the performing arts in particular, you get feedback straight away if you're not very good or if people don't like it, you know. And so I sort of segued into marketing and PR, and that really comes down to audience or customers or clients or call it what you will. And so for me, it's really about that customer experience, that audience experience, and being able to kind of bring that creativity and that idea of storytelling and that surprise and delight factor to things is really important to me. And part of that is, you know, understanding what motivates someone. And, you know, when you're on stage and you're playing a character, you're always going, okay, well, what's the motivation here, and trying to kind of inhabit other people's, you know, lives so that you can play them convincingly. And for a long time I was like, wow, how did I get into finance? And, you know, I still work in finance, and I realized that actually it gives you a lot of, you know, when you work in the arts, you also understand what collaboration is and how difficult, and that's really important. And, you know, often in these big financial firms, they're like, we're going to do collaboration workshops. And I'm like, okay, here we go. But I think that's been really interesting to kind of put a creative lens across something that is not seen as creative. But we always say that money is incredibly relational and a very emotional thing, and it's actually not that rational at all. So when you layer that onto it, I think it makes it really interesting.
So when did you both decide to write the book? What was that moment that you went, let's put this pen to paper?
I was actually on a dance floor.
I really wanted to write a book.
Sorry, Rach?
I said we really wanted to write a book. What did you say?
I said it was on a dance floor.
Yeah, Ange got us a book deal on the dance floor, which is one of her specialities, and then we had to write it, and it was amazing. Yeah. It was very hard work,
And how did that dynamic go? Because you're in two different cities, so how did you sort of keep that co-authoring dynamic work?
Well, we spent a lot of time thinking about, we called it our third thing, because, you know, we're both, you know, Rach is a therapist and I work in finance, and so we really wanted to we have professional lives outside of the book, you know, and outside of the work we do together. So we really wanted to make sure that this was something that we both felt incredibly proud of and was both our voices. And so we talked about it as being like our third thing, like our baby. It's like, this is what we're bringing into the world. And also, you know, Rach really kind of sort of shaped how we think about how we're going to approach this. And, you know, there's different areas that we are, you know, stronger in. And so we, you know, one of us would write, the other would look at it with fresh eyes, give feedback. And but every word in the book, you know, we've probably read, I don't know, about 1,000 times, Rach.
Was there a bit in the book or a chapter that you actually found quite hard to write, either sort of technically to word it correctly or perhaps emotionally, because it stirred something up in you?
My hardest chapter is the system sister, because when all that sort of inequity is sort of laid out like that, it just makes me so sad to really see that system. It sort of floors me. So I found that chapter often, it was just sort of a lot. That makes Ange angry, but it makes me sad.
Makes me really motivated.
So
I'm like, I'm going to crack it. Writing a book is hard work, you know, like, let's not pretend that it's like a walk in the park. And also, you know, Rach has her therapy practice, and I'm working, and families and commitments and everything. And so we often would write early in the morning, and we had a sort of a rule that we wouldn't, you know, do book things after 3 p.m. because both of us would be really tired and that's not the best time for us. And if you're trying to edit something at that time, you know, everything looks terrible, and you think, this whole thing's terrible.
You're too critical.
So sort of understanding each other and understanding where we can do our best work was a really good thing.
Was there anything when you were writing the book that you ended up changing your own habits as a result of, that you went, actually, I need to put my money where my mouth is here?
All the time, you know, like, I think, you know, those ideas, you have ideas and you just say them, but when you have to write them down, they have to, you sort of, it's like you run a fine-tooth comb through your logic, and you have to really get clear about what you really mean and what you're really saying. And in that process, it sort of was, I think we both did all those exercises again ourselves and tested them out again in ourselves. And yeah, we became sort of more thorough and more precise. And, you know, of course, we had to reference everything we said. We couldn't
think,
oh, didn't I hear at a party something about that? You know, so...
There's a lot of end notes.
Yeah.
Which is not naturally a space that Rachel or I feel, you know, really, like, that was the part that I liked least, was all the admin around writing a book, you know.
Right. Look, for someone listening who is feeling perhaps behind or scared or honestly feeling ashamed about money, I guess what's something that you'd like to say, like an honest message to them to kind of leave them thinking other than go buy my book?
I'll say there's nothing wrong with you. Yeah, it's okay. We all feel pretty weird about this stuff and nothing wrong with you.
Yeah, and I'd say, that and just it's okay to go slowly. It's okay to just maybe read one page or maybe, you know, we've tried to make it so there's lots of different ways in for people. And, you know, as Rach mentioned, she finds that first chapter, you know, really sad, and I find it like the biggest kick up the bum. And, you know, for some people that might be the case. You know, we've given as much information as we can so that people can share and find their own way into it. Yeah.
So if a listener...
One more thing is there's no right way to do money, just the way that's right for you. So just encourage each person to do it however they want to do it.
Mm.
So if someone's listening and did one thing differently starting right after this show as a result of hearing this conversation, what would be the first thing they should do?
I would say... I would say, you know, one of the key messages in the book is... start talking about money. And because money, so many women are socialized not to talk about money. And so in that silence, we're missing so much stuff and the system is just getting stronger and stronger. So my message would be start talking about money, like light up those WhatsApp groups, start talking to your friends about money. And there's you know, we're all learning this and you'd be surprised how actually no one really has got their shit together. So we're like, my message is like, let's just start talking about it. Right?
And mine would be exactly that, but adding like, find a good, safe friend and tell them your money story and hear their money story back. Like, start talking about that because it'll be fascinating.
And it's even talking out loud to yourself sometimes. Like you mentioned, asking, you know, do I need to buy that? Do I need to do it that way? You know, just have those conversations with yourself.
Well, I mean, you are used to the theatres.
Yeah.
So you can also do the exercise of talking to money yourself.
Yeah, definitely.
It'd be great fun.
Is there book number two on the way? Money, 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 money?
Money, 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 money. Well, it's
money, money, money for men.
Yeah. And it's actually being translated into Chinese, so it is going to be entering the Chinese market soon, which is very exciting, and we were quite surprised by that, but very delighted.
How do you see property fitting in all of this mix of money?
Well, it's one of the tools that you can use to help grow your wealth and build your financial security. But as you know, as we say in the book, not everybody has to buy property. That's one path to wealth creation. And depending on how you feel about it and depending on, you know, your lots of other things, it doesn't have to be the only way. Although in New Zealand we love a bit of property.
And look, you're on Property Matters, so you know,
I just had
to throw that in there towards the end. Yeah. Where can people find you, connect with your work, get a copy of the book and dig a little bit deeper?
Check us out at highmoney.nz on the internet, and our book Money, Money, Money is in all the good bookshops and also online.
You
can go to Allen and Unwin, our magnificent publisher's website, and get it direct from them if you'd like as well.
Yeah, and if you are a business and are listening to this, we also have a really great workshop that we've been doing. Now it's just an hour, And we kind of, I suppose it's kind of a speed run of the book, but we get a lot of great feedback
really
about
fun.
It. Yeah.
And is that available to anybody in that company?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's Money Month coming up in August. So if you are thinking you want something for your teams or for your employees, then we'd love to come.
Love it. And if you go into a bookshop and they haven't got the book available, ask for it.
Yes.
Make them order it, because that's how these fabulous Kiwi authors get their books out there.
And make some money.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for coming on a Monday afternoon. We really appreciate talking to you. Go and get Money, Money, Money. I've learnt some tricks tonight, and we'll look forward to chatting to you again maybe in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for tuning in on another Monday. Have a fabulous drive home. We'll catch you again next week here on Property Matters. Have a good one.